supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Work for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, 5 years ago, on a nice day like this spate of beautiful weather we recently had, on a nice day, I would sit out on my back deck with a book in front of me or not and just listen to the words, the birds, and feel the sun on my face. Well, today, my house is wired with Wi-Fi. I got my router. I got my iPhone. So when I sit on the back deck, I can now check my email and surf the web, stream online radio. I don't hear the birds when I do that. So there's no question that technology is increasingly shaping how we live, socialize, work, and learn. But is all this digital consumption changing the way we think, we feel? Is it really addictive? And do our brains suffer or benefit from multitasking? Well, here to talk about these issues and many more today are Clifford Nass. He's a Stanford University professor, director of communication between humans and Interactive Media Lab. Clifford Nass, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
He joins us from his office in California. Also joined by Gary Small, who is a professor at UCLA. He runs the Memory and Aging Research Center at their Center on Aging. His latest book is called iBrain: Surviving the Technical Alteration of the Modern Mind. Welcome to the show.
I'm delighted to be joining you.
And both Cliff and Gary are joining us by telephone from California. Our number is 888-477-9499. We would love to hear from you, love to hear your thoughts on how technology and multitasking is affecting your life. Let me start with you, Gary. How much time a day do you spend in front of a screen?
I'm afraid to add it up. It's I know from the recent Kaiser Family Foundation study that for young people, the average is about 11 hours if you include multitasking and you exclude schoolwork. I know that in my daily life, most of my time in front of the screen is spent at work on email and manuscripts and communicating with collaborators and so forth. But it sucks up a big part of the day, and it brings on kind of an avoidance of face-to-face communication, which concerns me.
Yeah, and, you're a pro in the area.
It's a challenge, I think, for all of us. We've seen the technology train come out of the station, and it's barreling down the tracks. We can't stop it. We need, however, to understand its impact, not just on our daily lives and lifestyle, but how it's affecting our brain.
Yeah, I've got to tell both of you guys that, you know, usually when I read research and you know, I get interested and curious and I look forward to the show, I got to tell you, I read this research. It scared the hell out of me.
Well, don't be too frightened, because
help me.
One thing good about the brain is that it's quite resilient. And we found in our studies that even in older brains, that there can be relatively rapid change in neural circuitry. So the brain can train and it can retrain almost at any age.
Well, that's certainly good news. Let me turn to you, Cliff. I assume you spend a lot of the day in front of a screen, yes?
Yeah, sadly, because of a laptop, it enables you to work and communicate basically anytime you're anywhere, and I'm a sucker for that, I fear.
So tell me, how does your brain feel at the end of the day compared to 10 years ago?
Well,
note the laughter.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. The from everything we can tell, even though I'm not a particularly a multitasker, it is a very strange feeling to essentially live in a world where that's delimited by, you know, a 15-inch screen. So seeing the outside world is a rather novel experience when you're really focusing all the time.
So tell me more about comparing how your brain feels today at the end of the day to 10 years ago.
Well, certainly what it feels like is, again, you've lived in an isolated world. Even if you're communicating with people via the email and chat, etc., you do feel more in sort of your own space. And I think a lot of what we're seeing with young people in multitasking and some of the effects having to do with the social world have to do with this feeling of, you know, it's a self-contained, constrained world that you can control and feel that you're getting everything you need.
Go on.
Well, I was going to jump in here because it's interesting in that it does isolate us, yet it also brings us together. Since I wrote iBrain, I've been invited to several colleges and universities to speak to the students and the educators, and there's a huge challenge among a lot of these professors in trying to get their students to stop texting during class. There was even one professor who said that she had them take a 5-minute texting break halfway through the class. So what is that about? You know, I think it expresses our need to be social animals, to be connected from moment to moment, how our brains sort of crave that. So in a way, we're isolated, but in another way, we're virtually connected.
And I wonder about the quality, though, of that connection.
Very different. I mean, we know that there's not the same kind of face-to-face communication. When you're having a conversation, you hopefully look somebody in the eye, you notice nonverbal cues, and there's a subtlety to that interaction that is lost in the technology abilities today in communication. In a way, the debate really has to do with the relatively primitive nature of the technologies. In the future, we may have virtual holograms that we can project just like in a sci-fi movie so that we could have a face-to-face conversation with a computer-generated image. And it might be so fine-tuned that our brains wouldn't be able to recognize the difference between a real person or a virtual person.
Well,
Is something worrisome about that, which is that now, even when people are having face-to-face conversations, they're often using other media as well. I live in a college dormitory, and I was walking by the hall one day when one of the students knocked on the door of another student and said, you know, I really have to talk with you. Something very serious has happened, and the other student let the first student in, and I saw her, the listener, go back to doing everything she was doing, working on her, you know, computer, chatting, etc., and then turned around and said, so, tell me what's wrong. I mentioned to her afterwards that in my day, when someone would come in, you would immediately, the first thing you would do is turn off all media and look directly at the person, and she said, well, that's no longer necessary. So I do think that even the, quote, face-to-face interactions we have are much more denuded and distracted, and I think that is an enormous social consequence.
Gary, I want to pick up on an issue that I'm concerned about is going on and has been going on. You know, you talk a great deal about multitasking, and it's not unusual for somebody to be at a meeting at the same time checking their emails and texting. It seems we have hundreds of choices almost every minute. And your colleague, Peter Wybrow, found that choice raises anxiety. So I wonder if our baseline anxiety as consumers, as Americans, has increased and has all this stimulation put us in a state of chronic stress.
I think it probably has. We don't have systematic data to support that, but it makes sense. And we talk about multitasking, and there's a related phenomenon that's been dubbed partial continuous attention, where we've got several programs going, and we're constantly scanning the environment for new and interesting information. So it's that vibration or that ping that tells us there's something even more interesting than what's going on at this point. And you know, you mentioned people are at conferences and meetings. At some meetings, I find it's a success if I can get people to put down their other media and just look at me, because they're so distracted by all this bombardment of information from moment to moment.
You talk about, Gary, continuous partial attention. What
right.
is that?
Well, what I mean by that, you know, think about your typical, I mean, even right now, I'm sitting in my office, and I'm working really hard to focus on this conversation, but I've got three computer screens. Now, I turned off the cell phone. That helped. But we're constantly being trained to look the other way, to notice this other information that might be coming in that might give us the impression that it's more immediate. And we're training a whole new generation of digital natives to function that way. I think of another experience I had with my 17-year-old daughter, and I said to her, you know, Rachel, when I'm having a conversation with you, I just don't feel you're paying attention if you're texting at the same time. And so she looked up at me from her texting and said, "Don't worry, Dad, I don't do this with my teachers," and then went right back to her texting. So it speaks to a new culture that doesn't place a lot of value on the traditional face-to-face conversation.
Tell us what this continuous partial attention, this related to multitasking, What does that do to us, multitasking?
We can speculate that, it as you mentioned, Peter Weibrow's work's pointing to anxiety. It suggests that it is stressful for the brain to constantly be on the alert. We know from studies from Robert Sapolsky's lab up at Stanford that animals under chronic stress have smaller hippocampal memory centers. So the area of the brain that focuses on memory is smaller, has fewer cells as a result of chronic stress, possibly because of stress hormones such as cortisol. So there is a concern that chronic partial continuous attention or multitasking could be stressful for the brain. In the short run, there are studies showing that we are multitasking more, and we have the perception that we're getting more done, but in reality, we're making more errors. So we're faster, but we're sloppier.
Cliff, you've broken multitaskers down into two groups, high and low multitaskers.
Right.
What's the difference?
Well, there's actually a shocking and startling number of differences. The most notable is the people who multitask the most, the high multitaskers, are least able to multitask. And this was a shock to me. I actually started this research wondering what was the special gift that multitaskers had that enabled them to do things I just couldn't do. And I was surprised to learn it's nothing. They actually can't do anything better. Specifically, they're very poor at filtering out irrelevancy, even though we would have thought that high multitaskers would be good at sifting the wheat from the chaff. They actually seem to like all chaff. They have much more disorganized working memory, and they're even actually worse at switching from one task to another based on our lab studies. Now, we don't know cause and effect, but we do know definitely that it's very bad for multitaskers to multitask, and there's some likelihood that constant multitasking doesn't just affect your ability to multitask, but to do the most fundamental things one would want a thoughtful brain to do. Filter out irrelevancy, keep memories well organized, and be able to transition from one task to another.
What is it that happens to our brains with high multitaskers that we can trick ourselves to think we're doing something well when we're not?
Well, what we think is going on is that high multitasking, we have some evidence for this, we're still exploring it, have what we call an explore mentality. And low multitaskers have what we call an exploit mentality. And the basic difference there is, do you think that you're going to be better off thinking harder about what you already have, or do you think you're better off discovering new information? And in every respect, it seems that the high multitaskers believe the new information is going to be more valuable than the old. That email that shows up is going to be just critical to you, whereas low multitaskers seem to believe, you know, just working harder with what I've got is the best way to go.
You've got two theories about why people multitask, or they're out there, about desire theory and revulsion theory?
Exactly, yes. The leading theory right now is that people multitask because, again, they believe that the new stuff is going to be great. And certainly, at least anecdotally, that's what we see among the young. When we look at older populations, there's suggestive evidence that they're not multitasking because they think the new is better. It's just that they're tired and frustrated with what they're doing. So I, for example, don't normally multitask, but when I'm writing something and just too frustrated, I'll play a game of Freecell or screw around or what have you. And the idea is that we multitask because we want to avoid hard thinking rather than we're attracted by new ideas. And so we're trying to distinguish, again, we think that older people who multitask are doing it more because they just say, I give up. And younger people are doing it because they think, oh, wow, what a great opportunity.
It seems to me that in both cases, it's a brain saying that it wants to feel better right now.
Well, it wants, we don't know about feel. There's some evidence of feel, but at the very least it says, I want stuff right now.
Stuff.
I really lust for something right this minute and because I think, either because I think it's going to be great or because I just think it can't be worse than what I'm currently doing.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's right there, whatever you
like. That's been the biggest, exactly. The biggest problem has been when I was in graduate school and struggling with the paper. If I hit a tough moment, I think, okay, well, you could get up and walk around, or you could just struggle through this. And I think the lack of attractive alternatives made us more likely to think really hard.
Yeah.
Now the attractive alternatives are so easy and so numerous, the amount of discipline we need.
Yeah.
Cliff, you know, I often get this question at conferences where people say, well, you know, I heard there's no such thing as multitasking. And, you know, when I think of it, that how could that be possible? Because I know I'm breathing and thinking at the same time. So those are two tasks. How do you respond to that question when it comes up?
Well, yeah, what is multitasking, Cliff?
Right. So the answer is that there's two things going on in the brain. We do have one brain. And on the other hand, though, that brain is divided into separate pieces that can take over certain tasks, not all tasks. So when we look at multitasking, and the multitasking I think that society is most concerned about, it's what we call medium multitasking. That is, doing more than one thing with that same part of our brain. The part of our brain that regulates breathing is different. It's not to say that if we don't think really, really, really hard, we can't actually make it tougher to breathe. That certainly happens. But we certainly have some slack resource for fundamental tasks. It's when you look at media. In fact, it's interesting that women are better at non-media multitasking, that is managing multiple physical tasks at one time. But a number of studies now suggest they're no better or worse at media multitasking. And again, it's a difference between using different parts of your brain or trying to heavily use the same part of your brain.
I'm going to take that note, and we're going to take a short break and talk about further dimensions of what technology is doing to our brains and what our brains are doing to technology and hopefully what we can do about it. We want to hear from you. Has multitasking affected your brain? Do you find yourself with a shorter attention span, a little more obsessive, checking your emails more than you would like to? Has it influenced your life more than you would like it to. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. My guests are Cliff Nass. He runs the communications between humans and interactive media at Stanford. Gary Small runs the Memory and Aging Research Center at UCLA Center on Aging. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY.
Support for WHYY is provided by Abington Memorial Hospital, now offering a new program for men with elevated PSAs who may be at risk for prostate cancer. The Prostate Evaluation Program brings together a multidisciplinary team of physicians and specialists who review cases together, providing recommendations and action steps for each individual. For more information, 215-481-MALE or AMH.org. Abington Memorial Hospital, the power to heal.
I'm Krista Tippett. Please join me on Tuesday, April 27th at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts. We'll explore Einstein's God and the fascinating interplay of questions, if not answers, that is emerging between 21st century science, medicine, theology, and philosophy. Call 215-893-1999 or visit whyy.org/member experience to get your tickets for this evening of ideas on April 27th. I'd love to see you there.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about technology, how it's affecting our brains, how it's affecting our lives, our relationships, and our perceptions of all the above. My guests are Gary Small. He runs the Memory and Aging Research Center at UCLA Center on Aging. Cliff Nass joins us. He runs the communication between humans and interactive media at Stanford. I'd like to hear now from David Meyer. He's a psychology professor at the University of Michigan, and he's the director of the Brain and Cognition Action Laboratory. He's found that how many tasks the brain can handle actually depends on the nature of the tasks. Here he explains a situation that many of us might be guilty of doing.
If you're cell phoning while driving on one of the freeways that you have there, and there's heavy traffic, construction, and so forth, then while you're driving, you may need to do a lot of talking to yourself in order to plan your next moves while performing the driving task. And if you're doing that, there's no way you can be having a decent cell phone conversation at the same time. If the driving's going to be less good, you won't be able to read the signs, you won't be able to think to yourself about your driving plan, and as a result, all of a sudden becomes dangerous, and you may even wind up crashing and burning. Similarly, if you are doing your driving, you're going to need to exercise your visual imagery channel, and that channel's actually needed for serious cell phone conversations, too. So, for example, if you're talking to your spouse about the new furniture and where to put that furniture in the living room, that requires visual imagery. And if you're devoting your visual imagery capacity to planning your living room layout, consequence of that, again, is going to be that your driving will suffer. So these two tasks, cell phoning and driving, even though they seem like they're really compatible with each other, actually conflict greatly, and that's the reason why, under a lot of circumstances, cell phoning while driving is at least as dangerous as if you were driving while being highly intoxicated or drunk.
Well, so there we have it. That was David Meyer, who's a professor of psychology at Michigan. There we have it. I don't think he said anything we really didn't already know. I mean, we know it's dangerous. We didn't know how dangerous. But Gary, I want to turn to you here. There's a disconnect here. Most people listening know what he said, that driving on the cell phone can be dangerous, yet people still do it. How do we trick ourselves into doing that, doing something that we know is unsafe?
We do it all the time. I mean, we overeat, we don't exercise enough, and we're putting our lives and the lives of others in danger every day when we're talking on the phone while we're driving. And the data are there staring us in the face. How can we do that? you know, I think we tend to be animals that still like immediate gratification. We think about what is pleasurable at the moment, and we use denial to make believe that those risks or dangers don't exist. It's just something far off in the future. And, you know, I think it's our, we've evolved and we've been able to survive despite that flaw in our evolution. But I think that's part of the explanation as to why we get away with this.
Mm. Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of people who've been waiting very patiently. Let's start with Lou. Lou, hi, you're on the air.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Sure.
As a new almost 64-year-old, I find that I'm very distracted, very easily distracted as I'm trying to do some of my photography work that I do and some other projects, and then I just drift off into either email land or surfing the web and looking at NPR, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know how to get a handle around that. I've been told I have some OCD and whatever, but I don't know how to rein in that impulse to just, hey, let's go look over here and see what's going on.
Hey, Cliff, do you think you could help Lou? Because I'm exactly the same age and I got exactly the same problem. So I'd like to piggyback on that cure.
Well, I think so many of us have that problem. And first of all, never stop listening to NPR.
Yeah, exactly.
I won't.
I'm glad you picked that up.
It's a huge problem because there's a lovely quotation that basically says, you know, no one really wants to think hard, and we'll do anything we can not to think hard. And what modern technology has given us is the opportunity not to think hard. And so I think the one thing we found, it's very interesting. We actually proposed to a group of undergraduates here at Stanford for 1 week to give up all multitasking, and we offered them some significant amount of money. I could not get anyone to volunteer. These students said if they were cut off for a week, they would just be doomed. So I think being a little older, we at least have hope that we don't believe that fully. So I think the answer is to try to remember the joy of thinking hard about something. It's something we've all lost. And that's the one piece of advice. Again, we do want to study it, but again, finding volunteers, at least among the younger age groups, is almost impossible. So much of their life is built around doing 3 or 4 media at once.
Lou, there's a Jewish organization of professionals called Rebooters, and they issued a Sabbath manifesto for just this past weekend. They wanted people to do things like avoid technology, shut things down for the Sabbath, 24 hours from Friday evening till Saturday evening, to avoid technology, connect with loved ones, find silence, and get outside. And, you know, I think if everyone were to practice this one day a week, it might help to rewire our brains. Gary, your thoughts?
I think it's essential. And I found that we can force ourselves to retrain our brains. I found it in myself. If I have a deadline with a paper or a grant, I will turn everything off. I am highly incentivized to meet that deadline, and I find I'm much more efficient. I do force myself to think, despite my brain not wanting to do that, and it surprises me how much I get done. When I talk with undergraduates, I have them do active listening exercises where they just, one person looks at the other person in the eye, and the person who's maintaining eye contact just listens and doesn't say anything. And it's very compelling. It has quite an impact on them. And once our brain is exposed to these alternative experiences away from the technology, it wants more of it. And so we can retrain ourselves to crave those offline experiences.
Yeah, I think ultimately the brain and beyond, if you will, ultimately seeks quiet, seeks serenity and slowness. Ultimately.
Well, we seek that, but we also seek thrills. I mean, the primitive dopamine reward system in the brain is always craving that new fix and experience. And this is where the debate about technology and addiction comes into play.
Well, let's talk about that, because, you know, there is a lot of argument that this stuff is addictive. I mean, there certainly is an obsessive quality about it.
Well, you know, it depends on how you define addiction. If you're looking at a constellation of behaviors that interferes with a person's everyday life, that it's an experience that if they don't have it, they crave it. They're often secretive about it. They have a very difficult time stopping it. Well, it certainly fits in with any kind of addiction, whether it's food, alcohol, drugs, and so forth.
So is there treatment for it?
In Asia, they've had freestanding rehab centers, particularly for teenagers who appear to be hooked on video games. Now, in this country, I believe in the state of Washington, is the first technology addiction center. But a lot of the centers that deal with addiction, any kind of substance, they're also beginning to deal with technology. So they're using the same types of treatment approaches that are used with any form of addiction.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Richard on the line. Richard, hi, you're on Voices.
Yes, hello, good afternoon. Good conversation, by the way. Enjoying the show. So, I wanted to make a comment based on the earlier conversation where you mentioned that multitasking basically trains the brain to look for, you know, to easy things. I think also from my personal belief and the people around me that people are training for easier things based on personal, for society, personal things such as, you know, maybe a marriage. Would someone basically a marriage or a job think, I'm training for easier things, so therefore I don't want to work very hard at it. I'm thinking I would rather change jobs or change marriage in order to. And would that have an impact with multitasking?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Cliff. I think it was you that pointed out that high multitaskers were not as good as at analytical thinking and had less of an attention span.
That's exactly right. We actually gave them standard analytic thinking tests, and we did find, in fact, that the high multitaskers did less well. We think that some combination of inability, again, the inability to filter, the inability to manage information. The question is really one of, if we assume that people like to take the easy way out in general, not everyone, but that's a general principle, then to what extent does society afford those easier options? And, of course, in this case, to what extent does technology afford those easier options? So, in general, if a society gives people an easy way and a hard way to do just about anything, they'll tend to take the easy way.
Give us an example.
So, for example, as far as thinking, if you present people and say, this is a really hard problem, and, you know, it's really challenging, and, you know, you will achieve it. You might achieve it eventually, you might not, or you say, this is an easier way to do it. It won't give you quite as much understanding, but, you know, it's easier, it's convenient, etc. The vast majority of people will take the easy way out. That's not even silly, and if we took every challenge our brain was presented with, we'd all collapse in exhaustion. So it is a reasonable evolutionary impulse that we like to take the easier way. The problem is what's happened with technology is the easier way has become so much easier. I was telling my students, you know, how much work it was to actually have to, you know, when you were writing something, to have to get up, walk around, you know, do all this. And, you know, now I say, and, you know, to watch television, I often had to go quite a long distance, whereas for them, television is sitting right on the same screen in the same place with one keystroke.
Cliff, do you remember what a library looked like?
even now what's funny to me is a lot of my students will go to study in the library, but yet they'll spend their time watching YouTube. And I explained to them that I might have been like that as a student. I can't say that I was any more virtuous than them, but there was no video in the library. And there was no chatting, you know, and the fact that, in fact, my students will often go to study as a group, and because they don't want to disturb other students, they'll chat. Not chat the way we meant it, that is, with words, which, of course, you know, other people at other tables would really discourage, but instead chat with each other as they sit next to each other while they're studying. And
yeah.
So I said, look, we may have been willing to do that if it was available, but it wasn't. So we actually studied in the library.
We've got to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about the social issues that come up around this and some other research that shows we are getting less skilled at social issues. And I want to talk a little bit about Asperger's. And, you know, could we all be growing on that continuum the more we rely on technology? And, of course, I want to talk about what we can do about all this. My guests are Cliff Nass. He runs the Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media at Stanford. I'm also joined by Gary Small. He runs the Memory and Aging Research Center at UCLA Center on Aging. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Ben Stiller was an action star in Tropic Thunder, which he wrote and directed, and played a self-involved male model in Zoolander.
I was thinking about volunteering to help teach underprivileged children to learn how to read. And just thinking about it was the most rewarding experience I've ever had.
He's now starring in the new film, Greenberg. Ben Stiller on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
It's a sacred tradition in the Muslim world, washing the body of a family member to prepare it for burial.
The body was still warm because she'd only been dead for like maybe 12 hours or so, but I wasn't freaked out.
How a modern woman meets ancient ritual. Next time on Tell Me More from NPR News.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about technology and what it does to our brains, the good news and the bad news. We're with Cliff Nass. He runs the Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media at Stanford. Gary Small joins us by phone also. He runs the Memory and Aging Research Center at UCLA, Center on Aging. So all of this begs discussion about ADD and ADHD, it seems they feed off each other here, that this almost creates ADD in order to adapt to a fast-moving society. Cliff, you want to tackle that?
Well, I unfortunately don't have a specialty in ADHD. I think Gary would know more. I can say that certainly people are being encouraged to look away. One of my favorite and most disturbing studies of this is newborn babies, when breastfeeding at a very young age, if the mother is watching television, will spend a great deal of time watching television because it's filled with faces and voices, which is what babies love.
Right.
So we may be breeding at a very, very young age the idea of focus and attention not being all it's cracked up to be.
Gary?
My sense is that it does contribute to the problem. There's controversy around it. There have been lots of studies showing an association between worse symptoms of ADHD and time with media, particularly television and videos. As a result of that, the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended no television and videos for children under 2. But others argue that a causal relationship has not been confirmed. So it may be that kids who are already having problems with attention are drawn to the media. But there are, you know, other studies that are worrisome as well. I think you mentioned Asperger's, which brings up the idea of us becoming an autistic-like society. There was a controversial study done where they looked at rainfall in Washington, Oregon, and California, states that have a lot of variability in precipitation, and they found that in years where there was more rainfall, there was a higher incidence of autism. And one interpretation was that with more rainy days, the kids spent more time indoors watching television. So there are these kinds of studies. There are our own observations of many young people and even older people, when they spend too much time with the technology, they tend to act more autistic, more drawn into themselves, less connected in the social ways that we're used to.
And have less social skills.
Well, I think that's part of the dilemma. And the question is, can we train social skills? Do we value them? I think we can teach people social skills. I think it's a critical problem for young people because their brains are still developing. The process of pruning, which means that 60% of synaptic connections in the brain are pruned away through brain development, that continues through adolescence. The frontal lobe of the brain is not completely developed in an adolescent. So complex reasoning, emotional skills, the ability to understand another person's emotional point of view. Empathy skills are not fully developed in a young person. So these are the people who are most exposed to the technology. How will this technology exposure shape the brains of the future?
And I have read some research that suggests that these skills are in there. I mean, we're almost born with them. That 18-month-old toddlers show empathy, show compassion, and apparently that can be drummed right out of the brain or into submission pretty easily.
We all have the capacity for that, but yes, it can be drummed out, and we need to help people, young people, learn these skills. They can be taught. That's one of the purposes of iBrain, is to help bridge the so-called brain gap, help older people, older digital immigrants, upgrade their tech skills, and help younger people with their face-to-face human contact skills.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Hank on the line.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think the point that I make of much of this, I watch my kids and I watch their friends and I watch my folks and my coworkers at work, my bosses and everyone else, and they've got their noses down in their machines, but there are people all around them. And, for example, when I'm face-to-face with someone, and it's something that's important for work, for example, I find that I'm feeling devalued, and I'm feeling what I am saying is devalued, because they can't interact with me. They're always with their electronic environment. I mean, you know, the bloody crackberries. It's almost like we have desocialized, if I could borrow a phrase from just a few minutes ago or a few moments ago. It's like we've unlearned our social skills. If there's something that's important to say, and it's important enough to say face-to-face, you know, because, you know, you need the attention of that person, and that attention isn't there. I'm really very sad about that, and sometimes I get rather angry about that.
Well,
I don't know what to do about that. I can't tell my boss to put her crackberry down, but, you know, still being able, you know, it's extra work to do what shouldn't be work, asking for their attention.
Yeah. I want to comment, and thanks for your call, Hank. You bring up an important point. I want to comment on something. Gee, Cliff, Gary, I forget which one of you guys brought it up. It was early in the show, about the future of technology, and we might have holograms where our brains actually experience it as a full person. My show next week is going to be on the human-animal bond and all the research about what happens when we touch an animal or touch another human being and how that releases oxytocin, that precisely the hormone that makes us feel good, the hormone that's associated with love and well-being. And, you know, there was an article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about the benefits of human touch. And that's what's missing here. And that's what I might want to say to Hank about his boss. If it's not socially inappropriate, maybe put a hand on his shoulder and say, hey, you know, talk to me. Any thoughts, well, Gary?
Well, we definitely are losing that, and it is sad. And Hank's, what he expressed is something that many of us experience and express, and we're not quite sure how to deal with it. Now, whether you talk about the future of technology, I think where it may be going is that those kinds of hands-on experiences will be simulated, and we'll perhaps use the technology to communicate in ways that will make old-fashioned communication simulated with the new technology. I mean, there's a whole area of research in computer brain interface and using electrodes, very much like EEG detection electrodes. Human volunteers can operate a computer just by thinking about it. So in the future, not only might we simulate putting a hand on the shoulder with the computer, but we could probably transmit our thoughts wirelessly to each other. So we could have conversations just by thinking about it. And it's in me, it conjures up lots of sci-fi movies and books that I've read over the years.
Yeah, not good ones.
Well, you know, yes, we're talking about the negative side here, and you know, I wanted to bring up there is a positive side here. I mean, Cliff was talking about we want to go for the easy road, and why not make our lives better? So, the upside of looking at this is let's understand how the technology works, how it's affecting our lives and our brains, and let's optimize it so that it improves our lives and doesn't take it over.
We've got a caller who's bringing up a question about generational issues. He's suggesting that this is not a big deal for younger people. It's a bigger deal for older people. Your thoughts, Gary?
Well, I would agree. I think that the young people don't see what's the issue. I mean, this is they'll tell you that reading books, that's kind of passé. I mean, it's so much easier to read things digitally, and it's us older digital immigrants that are struggling with it, that are we're having a tough time with it, but we recognize the value of the more traditional ways of communicating. Let's face it, our brains, it took hundreds of thousands of years to evolve to the point where we could have these face-to-face communications, where we could convey very detailed and subtle bits of information by looking at each other and conversing. And I think we're losing something if we let that go away.
I think there's something even deeper going on. I agree with Gary, absolutely, but I think there's something deeper going on, which is the valuing of attention. Throughout history, almost every society we knew, one of the greatest punishments they could do was ostracism. Basically say, we're not going to pay attention to you. And I think now what we're having is a world in which attention is no longer valued. In other words, the way you showed you really cared about someone in all those old songs and movies was you didn't notice anyone else. All you noticed was them, right? You couldn't see anyone else.
Well, Cliff, I would agree with you, but I think what another way of looking at this is it's not that we don't value attention. It's just it's harder and harder to get it because there's so much competition. Now it's not just Facebook, it's not just email or IMing, there's Twitter. We need to know from moment to moment what's going on in every, 6 billion of us, and it's overwhelming. We just can't get people's attention.
Well, I want to take another crack at the attention perspective. And by the way, anybody who wants to know what's going on moment to moment, I can tell them right now. are you ready? Not much. Not much is going on right now, and that's the important piece of information.
The way you said that, you really got our attention.
Yeah. Well, that's the point here.
We're old, so we really do pay attention.
But, at the same time all of this is going on, speaking of attention, there's a big move now towards mindfulness meditation.
Yeah.
And everybody's talking about the benefits, and more people are doing it, and that's about nothing but attention. It's just about cultivating attention. That's really what it is. So,
there's certainly evidence that people, if people are doing worse with multitasking, which they clearly are, and if it's changing their brains in ways that are destructive, which it's potentially they are, again, we don't know cause and effect, then the cure would seem to be practicing the skills that develop attention. And, you know, meditation is one we're also thinking about, and it's a very hard question. You know, I was presenting to a group of teachers, and then one of them stood up and said, well, how exactly do we teach to a group of students who don't want to pay attention? It's a tough one.
Yeah. I mean, you know. You can't get their attention to teach them.
Exactly. So, you know, it's like, what are the novel methods? You know, what is our understanding of that? And I said, boy, you know, in all the things I've learned, you know, we've always assumed that it starts with attention as the premise against which we then operate to teach.
It's always there somewhere. It's just a question of finding it. One of the most fascinating discussions I had was with a group of adolescents who I was trying to teach mindfulness meditation. Boy, was that ever a bust. But the bottom line was they said they were bored, and we wound up having the most fascinating discussion about what boredom really is,
How
they experience it, what it means, what goes on in their brain and their body. It was a wonderful discussion, and I had their full attention trying to figure out what boredom is. So attention's always there somewhere. It's a problem of finding, and that's a task we all need to do. Unfortunately, we have to close the show. We could do another 2-3 hours, and I would love to. Thanks, gentlemen, so much for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
My guests have been Clifford Nass and Gary Small. Nass is a professor at Stanford, director of the Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media Lab. Small's a professor at UCLA, runs the Memory and Aging Research Center. His latest book is iBrain, Surviving the Technical Alteration of the Modern Mind. Like I said earlier, next week on Voices, we'll talk about the bond we have with our pets, their place in the family, and the mental and physical benefits. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is a executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons and Stephanie Marutis. And I am very happy to welcome our brand new intern, Hannah Cope. Hi, Hannah. Welcome. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friend.